accession number 19585, Reel 2.
Yes, we have tape. Yeah, so the Oxfords.
Yes, that was right, the Oxfords, as I say. I was, then I went home at Easter, en route to, we had a week's leave. We had a week's leave in the middle of the course, actually, incidentally, because that's when I really began to make a strong pitch for the lady you met earlier, whom I'd met on the 16th of December on a blind date. My next door neighbour was sweet with a lass and he used to go to a dancing class, and he said, "What are you doing on Saturday?" And I said, "Why, nothing." He said, "Kathleen's got a friend. Her chap's gone to France. She's on a loose end. Would you like to meet her?" And I said, "Sure, that's right." So we met. And I say, from mighty oaks, little acorns, or vice versa. But that was up. Anyhow, I went and sort of cultivated the ground a little bit more. Then I went down to Harwell. No idea what I was going to. I was just posted to Harwell. Number 15 OTU, and I thought, well, what the hell's OTU? And I found out it was an operational training unit, and no idea what was going to happen. And got down there, and got into the mess, and then walked up to the hangars to see what sort of aeroplanes they had at this place, and now I was faced with a Wellington. And I looked at this enormous thing. God, it seemed to go on forever. And there was a wooden ladder sticking up into the under the nose, and an airman came clattering down, and I said, "Can I go inside?" He said, "Yeah, okay." So I climbed up, and there was this sort of magnificent green leather throne, and tuts and knobs and dials and levers all over the place, and I sat in the seat, and I put my head out of the window and my feet on the rudder bar, and I moved the rudder bar, and way back in the distance there I could see the rudder, and I knew, what's the Wellington, 85 feet long? And I thought, God, I'm supposed to fly, this. I did the course, that was it. I never found out whether I could fly a Wellington, because I had two pilots. You either had an instructor, or you were crewed up with another chap as first and second pilot, of which you alternated. And, well, we took it off and we put it down. But don't ask me whether I took it off or put it down again. I don't remember, but I must have done.
Did they have dual controls?
They did have dual controls, yeah. But you know, sometimes you never knew. Most of them did, because these were the Mark I's. This was before the Fraser Nash turret, where the nose just fell away. You'll have seen the photographs of the formation of 9 Squadron before the war, with the sort of sheared off nose. Well, those were the things we were flying then. The 1A, we just got a few 1As. The 1C hadn't materialised, because I first went to war in a 1A. Anyhow, we did our routine flying.
I mean, you presumably solos in a Wellington then?
No, never. You were always... Never. Well, no, you were always two pilots.
Yeah.
There were always two pilots. Never flew a Wellington solo.
But one of you had control, presumably.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
So you knew you were flying it.
Oh, you knew you were flying it, but I cannot ever recollect sort of squaring up and coming in for a landing without somebody else on the other side, and I was never certain whether I did it or he did it, or whether we both did it together. But we got it down without any grave...
What were the sort of vices and virtues of this aeroplane?
The Wellington was a perfect partner. If you treated her with the respect of a very gracious, willing lady, if you like, she would do whatever you wanted. I wouldn't care to take liberties with her, but providing you realised that there were certain things that you shouldn't do, you were all right.
What shouldn't you do?
Let's see, I'm just trying to... she wasn't easy to fly on one engine, so you didn't try that too much. You had things like flaps to think about. There were so many odd things about the Wimpy. When you were on the ground and you looked out, You saw the engine nacelles next to you, and that was fine. When you were airborne, you looked out, you saw the engine nacelles and the wingtip.
Oh.
And as you flew along, you'd see sort of this seagull attitude.
The wings flapping.
Wings flapping, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember commenting it to one of the chiefies about one time. I said, this was early days, a bit disconcerting seeing the wings flapping. He said, mate, time to be disconcerted is when they don't flap. So that was it. But it was a thoroughly good aeroplane. It was relatively easy to fly. It was heavy. It was slow in response. I mean, you turned this, you put the aileron on, and you had to wait 2 or 3 seconds before there was any noticeable change in attitude. So you wouldn't classify her as nimble, but she was a very stately, a very, very robust steed. And when once you've got confidence in her, and that was easily obtained, she had no vices at all. Because, if you like, up to a sense, forgiving. I don't know whether I've ever had an occasion to demand her forgiveness. And I know I did some mad things in it, which, when I think about it later, makes my blood run cold and wonder how the hell it was I managed to get away from it. But still, we're jumping ahead. No, I did the course.
When you put flat down, you had to...
Oh, yes. When you put flat, that was the odd thing about the Wellington. Normally, when you put flap down on most aeroplanes, the nose goes down. On the Wellington, it didn't. The nose came up. So you had to sort of trim forward. But if you did that trim forward, if you had to do an overshoot, then, of course, your trim was incorrect, because as soon as you put power on, the nose wanted to come up some more. And by the time you started to take the flap off, she got very, very nose heavy, and the last thing you want is a very nose heavy aeroplane when you're doing an overshoot with flaps and undercarriage down. So that was perhaps the one little trick, and there were one or two others on the early marks. You had to turn the hydraulics on and off. There was a little cock mount on the right hand side. It disappeared on the Mark 1C, but on the 1 and the 1A, you had this hydraulic pressurization, because the hydraulic system used to just go racing around all on its own. And then you had to pull this stop up, I suppose it was, which built up the hydraulic pressure, which enabled you to use your flaps and undercarriage and turrets and that sort of business. And that, of course, was something you couldn't...
You had to keep it topped up.
Yeah, you had to keep the thing up. When you pulled it into the up position, and it stayed there. But you had to remember to do it before you tried to take off. And you had to remember to close it after you'd landed. But as I say, that was relatively short period, because within about 8 to 10 weeks I was flying the Mark 1C, which had a different system altogether, and you didn't need to bother about the hydraulics. They were there all the time whenever you wanted them. But anyhow, we did, myself and a fellow called Sergeant Brooks, we were flying together, and we were posted together to Stradishaw, which was the holding unit, 214 Squadron. And I was out there for about 4 days. We did one cross country, Brooks and I. It was the first time I'd flown from runways, because Stradishaw had runways, and that was a marvellous experience. That really was. it was the first time we were caught out by bad weather, and we were flying, coming in on a cross country over Wales. We ran into cloud, and eventually they diverted us from Stradishaw to Mildenhall, and the cloud was about 400 feet, and they did one thing which was called a ZZ approach, which was a system where you lined up and you were given courses to steer from a radio. A radio goniometry was called. And then they would listen for you, and they would hear you pass overhead, because you were flying on these courses, and then they would say, turn left, fly such and such a course for X number of minutes. Rate 1, turn right onto reciprocal, and you go out again. And then you did the other thing, the same thing the other way. And they kept you selling reduced height. And the rather less attractive item was when you were leading, coming in, because it was all done by wireless, no voice, all done by wireless. So that while... Yeah, the wireless operator was passing courses to steer all the time.
You had a full crew behind.
Yeah. And they would say, calls to see her so-and-so, reduce height. And you were in dense cloud, and you watched the altimeter going down and down and down, and you were watching the airspeed indicator because you were on, you had undercarriage and flaps down, and you were still in cloud, and seemed to go on and on and on. And then the voice would say, look ahead, you should any moment see the runway or the airfield straight ahead of you. And you looked up, and there on the end of the field was the radio hut and the grass field stretching out, and you were probably about a couple of hundred feet. And that was a relief.
And this was, I mean, when they say look ahead, it was a Morse signal, was it?
Oh, yes, yeah.
So,
yes,
yeah. You know, it had to be pretty quick Morse, didn't it?
Oh, yes, you had to have a first-class radio off of it.
Yeah.
But it was a tremendous confidence-building exercise.
Yeah.
But that was the first time ever, if you like, had a blind landing. I don't know who landed it that day, whether Brooks was flying it or I was. I think we both were. I think we were both, shall we say, apprehensive would be a kindly word to use. There was a certain amount of ring twitter up in the front, as you can imagine. And there, when the wireless operator, so the wireless operator was behind the pilot, the navigator was standing in the archway, and he was passing the paper up. And the thing is, I think the actual, because it was all done in Q code, QDM, QSO, Q this, Q that, Q the other. And the thing was, in effect, sort of saying, land. In fact, what the actual message was, and this is where it got its name, was ZZ, which means go ahead and land.
Mm.
And as soon as you got ZZ, you looked up, sure enough, there was the airfield. But we
didn't have RT in those days, did your voice?
No, it didn't work very well. It was this thing called a TR-9, which was a very indifferent piece of machinery. And then, 2 or 3 days later, we were both posted to 9 Squadron. And I got there 7th of May, 1940.
And that was where?
Honington. Mm-hmm. And I was crewed up with a Sergeant Douglas, who had been a second pilot up till that time. He'd been on the December the 18th raid when we lost 11 out of 20, how many it was. Anyway, well, 11 Wimpies were shot down, and December the 18th was a date to conjure with. And they'd been up in Lossiemouth, bombing Stavanger after the invasion of Norway. And then the squadron was pulled back, A, because presumably the powers that be reckoned that something was going to happen on the Western Front, and B, because the nights were getting too short up there for the Wellington safely to operate under cover of darkness. And then on the 10th of May, of course, the balloon went up in Holland, and that was the very first trip I ever did. And we took off about 5-ish in the evening. It was still daylight, and we got over Holland, Valhafen. The airfield for Rotterdam was the target, which the Germans had seized. They'd landed gliders and God knows what. And the Dutch were supposed to go in and try and retake the airfield, and we were to act, if you like, as the artillery bombardment. And I remember Dougie saying, right, you go back, stand in the Astrodome and keep a lookout for fighters, anything, you see, and I'll fly it. And I went back in the Astrodome and looked around. And I saw, and my heart stopped, and I saw another aircraft, and I recognised it was another Wellington. And then straight ahead of us, you know, these bead curtains that you see in front of beach huts and on doorways in the summer, coloured lights, and they twinkle as the wind catches them. It was just one of these hanging right across the sky, straight ahead of us, and it was light flak. And we just went straight for it. I remember sitting there like a petrified rabbit watching these coloured lights going left, right, left. As we got to them, they appeared to separate. And then there was a thwack, and there was a hole in the starboard wall, and a piece of fabric came up on the starboard wing. And I remember saying to Dougie, we've been hit. So he said, right, where? And I said, starboard wing. Anything? And I said, no, oh, it's just torn fabric. He said, all right. And we pushed off through, across the coast, came out to the North Sea again. And he said, right, you fly it, I'll go back and have a look. So I took over and flew it back to...
You'd released your bombs by this
time. Oh, yes, we'd bombed because I wouldn't know anything about that, because I was, as I say, watching this stuff, and the navigator was the bomb aimer in those days. And Dougie came back and sort of stood beside me whilst I flew in, and we crossed the coast. And as soon as we saw the beacon, the airfield beacon, Dougie took over. And we came in and we landed. And we were very unpopular in a sense, because we were one of the first, I think we were the first or second to land. And what had happened was that the light flak had punctured the starboard tyre. So we touched down, and then as failed the aircraft, Doug tried to hold it, but couldn't. And we came to a stop 90 degrees across the flare path, which meant nobody else could land until either we'd been moved or they moved the flare path. So they got us out. I remember climbing down, and you could smell the sweet smell of petrol when we went out, and there was this sort of gunge. It's like a pustule carbuncle under the side of the wing where the cell ceiling had been pushed through, and petrol dripping from it. And you could hear the engines ticking, and once you moved away, you could smell the burnt exhaust disappearing. And God, the grass felt lovely under your feet. Wonderful. Anyhow, that was it. They pumped us into a wagon, drove us back, debriefing, down to the mess. We were probably halfway through our first beer before the next man landed. And that was the first trip I did. And I went on with Dougie. We had Dunkirk. That was a spectacle. That was the first time when I really did the operation with Dougie, acted as, if you like, a second pilot. He said, right, you're going to do the takeoff tonight. We had 16 250s, I think it was. You're going to do the takeoff and fly up to the target. Bottom. Yeah, fly up to the target. He said, then I'll take over as we come up to the target. And then you can fly it back again and land it, which is what happened. And we took off, and again, it's one of those moments or periods in your life. We were flying out, coming up to crossing the coast at Orphan Ness, and there were two other wimpies ahead of us, sort of in their several air currents. Yeah. Mm. And it was the time that the film Henry V was on. And you thought, no gentleman of England now abed. And it was great. You know, you really felt that you were doing something. And then we got to the coast and turned right, and there was another sunrise. Or appeared to be. And we lost the sight of the other aircraft. And that was Dunkirk burning 90 miles away. And we got to, we came into to the northeast of Dunkirk, because you could see it down on the right. And we didn't want to go anywhere near the Navy, or anywhere near the beaches, or anything like that, because they didn't ask which side you were on, boy. And came down, and the target was a place called Breg, or Berg, or something like that. It was a gesture. Because there was nothing we could do. There was no target. Somebody, I remember, because Dougie said, I want you to drop the bombs. Jock Gilmore, the navigator, will be watching to see where we're going, the headings and the time, so that he can plot the movement, and I shall just fly it. And he said, you'll have to pick up targets of opportunity. And somewhere, somebody down there had dropped a flare, and it was just like flying over a sea of watered milk. And all you could see are the flashes of the guns. And through this.
Not firing at you? Or
no. Presumably it was just the war going on down on the ground somewhere. And the sea was like a sheet of beaten copper with the flames from the oil refinery. And the buildings were pennanted with flags, but the flags were flame. And it was an awesome sight. And all you did, you sort of saw a flash and you thought, well, now, where's that? And I don't know, presumably you thought you were aiming at where you remembered that there was a flash on the ground some 10, 15 seconds ago. Mm. But we came back. And
did you drop all your bombs at once? Or just
oh, no, we were trying to pick
something, but the only thing we would wanted to make sure is we didn't drop them within the perimeter. So anything that we could find on the other side, and there was nothing to see really. It was, I don't know, I suppose the only thing you could hope was that perhaps you'd made some Axis military establishment duck and pause for a few seconds so that another boat got away. But we'd no idea what was going on down there. All we were doing, we were just stirring the pot. But it was, as they say, it was an awesome sight. Back again to Honington. And I just went on. Dougie was screened. A chap called Flying Officer Smalley took me on then, and I did about three trips with him, I think.
Dougie was screened, what was that?
He meant he'd finished his tour. Because he'd been at the squadron when the war broke out, and he'd done Norway, and he'd done December the 18th, and then he'd done his lot, and he was screened with one or two other people.
So he'd be rested, or
he went to rest. Another epic that I remember particularly, and I've written about several of these things for magazines, is that we came back one night, and I've only been in bed about a couple of hours, and the WOP came in, and took down the blackouts, and said, we're on a search. Pilot Officer Butler is down in the North Sea. Well, Butler's navigator had the room directly opposite me in the mess. A fellow called Naylor, Charles Naylor. Funny fellow, very nice chap, very quiet, desperately quiet. Never drank, never smoked, never swore. You always felt that he was the epitome of a Victorian choir boy, although Victorian choir boys probably had pretty evil reputations on the quiet. But he was the sort of thing that you found in, too good to be true. But he was a lovely fella, great chap. And not long before, we'd come back from a trip, and I was in bed, and I was just getting up, actually, and there was a knock on my door, and Naylor was there. And he came in, and I said, hello, what's up? And he looked at me, and he just collapsed, burst into tears, and said, Bob Hewitt's missing. His wife's expecting a baby. So what the hell do you do? I was just turned 20. He was about the same age. Not much. I mean, total embarrassment in a sense. The chap my own age is blubbing his heart out with his head buried in my blankets. So, I don't know quite what, but a few platitudes. Anyway, he got up and he said, thank you very much. I had to talk to somebody. And off he went back to his room. And it was only two or three days later that I went out hunting the North Sea for him and his crew, because the Winco had gone out as soon as they got the SOS. It wasn't an SOS. We had this IFF, identification friend or foe, and if you switched it to mode 2, it sent out a different signal which indicated distress. And that had pulsed through, and they identified the aircraft and roughly where it was, and then it disappeared. And the Winco and one of the flight commanders had gone out looking for it, and then they called out some others of us, and I went out looking for it with my crew. And we did a square search, which is a business where you fly, and then you turn through 90 degrees, then you turn through 90 degrees, then you turn through 90 degrees, and each leg is progressively bigger so that you cover a wide area. And we were flying along, and the WAP, or I think the navigator, said, there's something in the sea over there. And I turned, and saw enough, we could see something in the sea. And we thought, oh, God, we found them. Marvellous. So went over there. And it was a yellow barrel, oil barrel, a bulk of timber, and the whole lot snarled together with rope. Flotsam from another wreck or something. So we signaled base and said what we'd found, and they said, noted. And came back. And his name's on the panel in Runnymede. Along with his crew, And Hewitt was shot down over northern France and killed as well. What else? I just pressed on. We had one or two interesting trips. I remember on one trip, forget where we'd went, but we were coming back, and the rear gunner said, "There's balloons." We were about 11,000 feet, I suppose. "There's balloons." And I said, "Not this height." And the navigator looked out. He said, "There are." And sure enough, it was a brilliant moonlight night. We were passing virtually over the middle of the Ruhr, and they got balloons flying at the height that we were. Now, this was sometime in 1940 when the Germans realised quite rightly, A, that we were on the way back, and therefore we didn't possess any offensive weapons, if you like, and B, if they kept stum, we wouldn't know where the hell we were. And the one thing to indicate that there was a target underneath was to shoot at the aircraft overhead, because this is what you tended to do. You didn't identify the targets by careful map reading or anything like that. You saw where all the muck and filth was coming from, and you thought, well, that must be it. So if they kept quiet, we kept quiet. But I remember seeing these balloons and doing a sharp 180 and heading back into the centre of Germany in order to get away from these damn balloons. And we came round, God knows where we'd been. But navigation was not a fine art in 1940.
Before the Pathfinder?
Oh, good Lord, yes. Long before the Path, long before radar. It was by guess and by God, I think, was the submariner.
All dead reckoning, was it?
It was all DR, yes. DR and Astro, if you were lucky. And none of us were any good at that. We were grotesquely undertrained. We could fly the aeroplanes. But where we flew them, and what we did when we got there, was in the lap of the gods. I mean, what was the Burns report said? Only 5% of all aircraft got within, 10% got within 5 miles of their designated target. I'm not the least surprised. Because, I mean, some things you couldn't miss. I mean, places like Cologne on the river and one or two other places. But I mean, when somebody said, go and find an oil refinery at Gelsenkirchen, which was a favourite target, we went there time and time and time again, which was probably about as big as the car park down in the centre of the town square in Henley, in a mass of built-up area covered with smog and fog and filth and what have you, and being shot at all over the place. I mean, it was... Well, I don't know. I mean, you just believe what the navigator said. He said, yes, there, left, left, right. I think that's it. Okay, bomb's gone. You thought, thank God for that. Let's get home.
Going back to these balloons, it strikes me as extraordinary. Have you got a balloon at 11,000 feet?
Well, it was around that height.
You've got 11,000 feet of steel cable.
I know, yeah. I didn't believe it.
To hold that amount of cable up.
I didn't. I 11, 10, it was around that figure.
Yeah.
It was I never even thought of running it. It was the only time I ever saw balloons at that height. The only time I ever saw balloons.
It was tethered, was it?
Oh, it was, yes. And there were more than one of them. They were lying like dog turds on the pavement.
They weren't Zeppelins, right?
No.
You said earlier on it was a very forgiving aeroplane.
Yeah.
Actually, what I'll do, I'll stop the tape just here.